Welcome to the Soccer Central Podcast.
Well, hello there, football fans, and welcome to Thursday's Soccer Central Podcast. I'm James Sharman, joined as always by John Molinaro. We'll get to some Champions League later in today's show. We'll get to the Premier League weekend as well. But off the top, we have a very special guest, a good friend of the show, in the studio for the entire podcast. It's Adrian Bradbury of Football for Good. Adrian, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you in person once.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks for having me. And yeah, nice to be home for a stretch.
Going to say, Adrian's been in Uganda for the last 18 months.
Yep.
With the Gulu United Football Academy. Now, we've had you on the show before, but for those of our listeners who haven't heard from you before, quickly surmise, what is Gulu United? What is Football for Good? What is the plan here?
Yeah, so Football for Good, we set it up. There's a, like, we all know the names of, you know, number, thousands or hundreds at least of West African players who have made the jump to the professional ranks. And we could, it'd be hard to name many from East Africa. Victor Wanyama probably is the only one that comes to mind for anybody. And yet the same culture of the game exists there, the same opportunities there. It's just been a region with a lot of political unrest, a lot of problems. And so it's been late to come, but all the facets are there for the game. I've been working kind of in the region during the Civil War in Northern Uganda. And so this was started as a way to give back, and it's morphed into a professional academy where we believe we can, you know, produce players, give them a professional pathway globally. And then hopefully the dollars that come back from what we're doing can sustain the academy and give us a chance to grow, but could also provide an opportunity for us to invest in a whole facet of other initiatives, entrepreneurs, programs to be play a small part in redeveloping in the region.
So when this idea first came to you, was it more of a charitable endeavor rather than business? Did the business come secondary?
Yeah, I think it was more, even beyond charity, I think it was just more youth. I had helped, there was a senior team in the region when I was doing a bunch of work at the and maybe in 2007, 2008. And so I helped them. And it was just too much too soon. They didn't have the resources to be able to sustain a top tier club. And so I said, you know, if you ever want to dig in again, the guys that I'd worked with there, I'm happy to do it, but let's do it with youth and let's build from the bottom up. And so it was more giving youth a chance. And I guess, like, I've seen, because of the advocacy I've been engaged in there and because of the projects we supported, there's a lot of programs in these regions that are for all. So there's clean water, there's school fees for kids, and all those things are vitally important to touch as many kids as possible and make an impact. But there's very little in most of these communities for kids who are good at anything to become great at it. And that creates this massive leadership gap. For us, it's football, the tool that we're using to do that. But there's a whole, we'd love to be able to invest in kids that show great acumen in business and arts and others as well as we grow. So because we know, like, even if we're amazing at what we do on the academy side, it's a small percentage of our kids are going to make it. So what about the other 95 to 98%? What kind of tools are we giving them? So it was really more of an investment in youth and then the kind of social business aspect, you know, kind of just morphed over the last kind of few years as we just saw the opportunity and the, you know, the gap that there was, not just in Uganda, but all of East Africa, which we believe we could grow.
She mentioned that Adrian moved his entire family over there 18 months ago, his wife and his two young boys who aren't so young anymore. I guess they're in their teens? Or
yeah, 13. Owen's 13. Isaac will be 16 in October. Yeah.
Right, right. So you get these kids, you move the family to Uganda. I mean, there's a huge culture shock there to begin with. You know the lay of the land.
Yeah.
How was it for the family as an adjustment?
Yeah, you know what? The adjustment was really quick. For my boys, like, so they love the game and they're a big part of the game here. So yes, you know, how we live and electricity is intermittent and we'll go 2 weeks without water. And a lot of those things are not normal day to day living in Toronto. But you know, my wife's a teacher, the boys are homeschooled. So they have school during the day, they play football in the afternoon and they sleep, eat, drink football because that's everything there. And which is also another, what makes that place special. We have a lot of conversations in Canada about where our youth development is. And I'm a big believer that, you know, the culture of the game is paramount and that exists there. You know, that doesn't exist here. We have lots of chatter around all the immigration that's here and the variety of nationalities and people who love the game, but it's not on the front page of the sports pages. And you know, so that it's not ingrained in our culture. It's everything there. And so for my kids, it's amazing for them. And the competitive environment we've created on the pitch, like my boys have learned to compete in a whole new way. And so they're really thankful for that. For my wife, I'd say it's been most challenging for her, But she, you know, she's getting much more involved in the academy as a whole, doing academic advising and working with some of our boys evenings and weekends, you know, as we try to do more for them to prepare them for opportunities beyond football, but scholarships and others. So it's quickly become a family business for sure.
Adrian, what led you to do this? What was the, because this is a massive undertaking, mm-hmm. I can imagine. And moving your family there, that must have been, you know, an interesting conversation you had sure. with your wife and kids at the time. So what was the inspiration behind all of this? What inspired you to do it?
Well, it's a good question. Like back when I did, like when I originally did Gulu Walk and my original advocacy in 2005 was kind of how I ended up there. I think for this project, I think the one thing I mentioned around that good to great and that leadership gap in these communities, like I've spent enough time there just to see that even post-war, it feels like the community plateaued. It's plateauing in a lot of ways. Like there aren't a lot of leaders and people driving and innovation and doing things in a different way. And so that's the one thing that strikes me and connects with me. I think the other thing is, I think there's a real kind of social business and maybe separated business opportunity there. Like in the last window of over 2 billion, I think, when just in the Premier League alone, and, you know, 4.5 billion in 2015, just on transfers. And there's this huge pot of money in this global business where it doesn't seem to be trickling down. And so the talent is there. It's just, there's very little investment. And for the shoestring that we run our academy on and the pathway they create for the kids, you know, that part, I'd love to, you know, I don't want to position it as this Robin Hood kind of thing, but there's just a missed opportunity and a huge competitive advantage. And that's how I approach it. Like, as I'm starting to talk to partners and talk to clubs, what charity and the impact is great. And that's really important. And that needs to be part of the story, but the football needs to be what leads. Like, if this isn't a really good football opportunity for a partner, then they shouldn't be working with us. They shouldn't be doing it.
What are the kids like? Can you give us a kind of a character sketch of?
So I would say, it's funny. So off the field, they're very quiet, very reserved. It's a very hierarchical culture. And so, and the academic system is very rote. So it's sit in the desk, repeat after me, kind of a very old 50s, 60s British kind of system. And so it's, so the kids are really quiet. So that has been one of our challenges. So they're not naturally great problem solvers, risk takers, off the pitch. I think on the pitch, incredibly scrappy, passionate, kind of real fighters on the field. And so we've been able to kind of combine the academic, and I've created and are curating our own character curriculum to give them the tools around initiative and integrity and fear versus danger and mindfulness, and try to give them language around what, it, not just classroom, but things they can do on the field. It's funny, I'm trying to characterize the type of player. Like, it's everybody wants to be or believes that they're a holding midfielder for some reason. And I think, and we don't, you know, we're not going to export a bunch of holding midfielders. Not that's what other programs and clubs are talking to us about. But I think part of the kids are really, really good on the ball. We'll do ID at U12 or U13, and they're incredible feel, incredible vision. And I think it's like that. And I think they all want to be central midfield players, is because they often play in an environment where there's 30 kids and they're fighting over one ball. And so I just need to get on the ball. I don't want to run in behind space. And, you know, I need to be close to the football all the time. So there's a variety of talent, but very good technically. And it's actually changed how we ID. Like, early we were looking at really, really young. And, you know, like the systems, you know, here in Canada, and getting kids in at 8 and 9. And we're fully residential, which creates challenges at kids that young. And we've noticed that we don't need to be in a hurry, because they're on, like, the reason we do that here is because they need the hours on the ball. They need the time. It's not a problem there. Even if we leave them until they're 12, they're on the ball all the time, whatever shape, form of ball that is. And so if anything, you could ruin them, because those are the times and everything's connecting. And for them to just have the freedom to play, I think benefits them a lot. So yeah, good technical players. And I said, like, even my own kids, like, really scrappy, determined, or run through a wall. And our younger groups are playing friendlies against some, like, men, like our 16s play amateur men's teams, our 18s play pro teams. And so we're giving away a lot, but not intimidated, not afraid. They get after it. So
what are the age grades again for the program?
So right now we're running a U15 side, which is mostly 13s and 14s, a 16, same kind of a 15 and 16 mix, and then a U18 group, which is our best kids. So in that group, we have a 15-year-old goalkeeper, and then we have a couple of overage kids that have been kind of part of the program from day one.
So, you know, Africa's been mined for talent before. There's been some very shady business dealings over the years between European clubs and Africa. Were there any trust issues you had to overcome when you first arrived?
Well, I think what was lucky is because I had been doing work in the region for almost 8 years before this all started. So I had a lot of good relationships. So I agree with you. I think, you know, as we think about going and doing ID elsewhere and trying to build, like, we need to be careful and mindful and smart about how we do that. And I totally agree with you. Like, this is, you know, new frontier in regards to youth football. And I like to position that there's pirates and there's pioneers, and there's way more pirates than there are pioneers. And so it's, we haven't had them kind of snooping around or part of our program yet, but we know we have to be mindful. And that's as we start to have conversations with clubs, what they like about what we're doing is that there are people running programs just trying to hit the jackpot with one, right? And make a buck, sell them to Arsenal, or, you know, it happens still. There's, without programs and without a developmental environment, kids are just that good. They'll slip, they'll be able to make it on their own. And so we want to make sure they have all the tools to make it. Like, I think way more kids off the continent could make it if they had the academic, social, character skills to do it. Because I think they get dropped in these environments and you never hear their name again because they just can't manage it. You know, that it's a lot to ask of a 17-year-old kid who's never stepped out of his country and has a very poor academic background, has never been challenged or has never had to fail, and all of a sudden now be just one of the kids. It's a lot to ask for them. And you know, we need to be able to provide. And it just having these agents and it's doing a disservice, not only to the communities, but to the kids.
Sounds like all this is a rather expensive proposition project. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you can talk about some of the funding issues or challenges that you have to overcome to do all this.
Yeah, like we can certainly do it on a lot. You know, one of the advantages, it is cost effective there, like what we can do, how we can staff, what things cost. Like, we can do it for an eighth of the cost of what you might do it in the US or Canada if you look at MLS academies in comparison. And so we can do it a lot cheaper. Yes, we need to fund it. So initially, over the first kind of year and a half to 2 years, has been individual philanthropists who have, you know, supported some of my work in the past, who have, you know, I said, you know, here's this new crazy idea I have. Do you guys want to help me out? And so that's where it started. And we're taking support on the investment side, so on the social business, so you can be an investor and a partner in what we're doing, or you can kind of give on the charitable side, and those dollars kind of help support the academic and other programming that we run. So the future of what we're trying to do is kind of twofold. One, we think there's corporate partners and people we're starting to talk to that are kind of multinationals that are in sub-Saharan Africa that we're starting to make links with, who like what they like the leadership angle. They like the good to great message that, you know, they've done all those projects I talked about earlier, and so they want another way at it. But the sustainability of what we're doing is to have an exclusive professional club partner. Like, it's, can we find somebody EU, MLS? And we're starting to have more and more conversations and getting some real interest around some funding support, whether it's club funding and or a fundraise through the foundation or other means to provide our operations in exchange for exclusive access to our kids, providing a pathway and you know, coaching support to what we're doing. And also, you know, there's the goodwill and the incredible kind of halo that comes with the impact that a club can make. And they also, like, talent's hard, getting harder and harder for these clubs, and especially the kind of middle to kind of lower tier teams. You know, it's hard to compete. You know, look at Brentford in London as an example, who just closed their academy, and they did that because they can't compete in London. You know, you have to compete with Arsenal and Chelsea, and, you know, the list goes on. And so they know that they need to be creative about where they find kids, and they need to know that the talent that they put into their system needs to be better. They're spending a lot of money on academies, but I'm not sure the pipeline is big enough or good enough to be able to produce pros at the end of it. And we you know, we're an interesting kind of new way at it.
Do you find that the smaller clubs are more open to listening to you and meeting with you than the big boys?
Yeah, so we've had both. I'd say it's kind of that mid rung. Like, you know, I've done a full outreach, you know, throughout the EU. Like, we're getting, most of our interest is coming from Denmark, Sweden, Portugal. I spent a bunch of time in the UK, and I met with kind of high folks in big clubs like Chelsea and Tottenham and Southampton. We've had those conversations. It's In the UK, it's also an immigration issue, and you know, Brexit and everything. It's a bit messy right there right now, and so it's a bit trickier there. I think the MLS is a really good fit, and we're getting some really great feedback from clubs. I spent a week in the US, you know, meeting with a bunch of clubs, and so it's resonating because they're the ones, to your point, like we want somebody that needs us, because it's not just funding support. We want a partner who's going to commit human resource, who's going to spend time around a boardroom table talking about this and figuring out how they can make the most of it. Because like our kids, we have some special kids. It's going to take us another 3 to 5 to really be consistently producing kids. But I have, you know, I have one right now at the U14 level that I believe I could place in any academy on the planet. And I have a half dozen, I think, already at a kind of mid-tier level. And we're only a year and a half in, and we've just scratched the surface on identification. So there's lots of room to grow.
That is the big moment, you know, you're waiting for, finding that one kid.
Yeah.
When that one kid makes the jump, you know, you get more notoriety. How close do you think are you? You got the kid in the under 14s right now, but how close do you think you are from positioning a kid into a club's academy elsewhere?
Yeah, like I think we're really close. To be very honest, if we have an MLS relationship, like, you know, we're hopeful within the next year we're going to have a relationship. If it's MLS, like, I believe right now I have one or two kids that could play at a USL kind of tier, you know, TFC2 kind of B, you know, reserve side level today, who are really raw, who maybe have are late bloomers and have an opportunity to grow. On the academy side, like I said, we have one or two that, you know, we want to give them a couple more years of development, but I believe we're, you know, 2 years away tops to really being able to showcase what level of talent and what we can produce. Like, we're also really confident in just what we're doing on the pitch day to day. Now I've traveled enough and seen enough academies, and the attention to detail we're spending and where, how our kids have grown on the pitch has been incredible to watch. So I think we have a handful, a couple that are ready today at a more senior level, but from the academy, I think we're, you know, 1 or 2 years away.
So when you find that kid or kids and they make that move to an academy or a team, you retain the rights to that player? Is that how it works? Or you'll retain a percentage of that player for transfers?
Yeah, I think it'd be a percentage of. So part of the, obviously it'd be a free move to the partner club, and then, you know, retain a percentage on future sell-on and provide an upside. I think I went in early thinking, you know, we could run our own system and we could, you know, kind of, you know, for lack of better terminology, kind of shop the kids to the best environment for them and then have the dollars all come back to us. But from a long-term sustainability, it's hard to maintain that, keep dollars coming in, you know, to John, to your question, like it's not easy. And so this, I think, is a nice compromise for us. And we need the human resource support too, like I said, not just the cash to really do it well, because staffing is our biggest problem. Like my kids, I have one international coach who's leading, and I have a couple who are really, really good. I think some of the others, you know, it's a long process for us to develop coaches. Like our kids are past my staff, and so we need to continue to do coach development and coach education and get more in. I think our kids in the academy are likely our future coaches.
Yeah, right.
But we're still a few years away.
Is that difficult to find qualified coaches to make that jump? I mean, that's a big move for anyone to Uganda. How hard's that been?
Yeah, it's hard. And I don't think like it's uniquely difficult for us because what we're trying to do and the developmental environment we're trying to create is brand new. And so it's a winning culture. And so to put a 15-year-old on the pitch against a Premier League team is not something anyone else in the country would do. And so it's been a real education about what we're spending time on. Like, why are we spending so much time on character? Why are we spending so much time on culture? Why are we, you know, putting these guys in positions where it's so difficult for them week in and week out? And so they just want to win. And so, you know, that's been really, really challenging. And then the tools of style, like it's really, we're working on guided discovery. We want the kids to fail. And it's traditionally kind of a shouting, you do what I say. And if you don't do it, then it's your fault, you know? And so it's been trying to change the idea. The coaches now are under the, like, if it's not working, if your drill's not working or the activity you're running is not working, then it's your fault. So if the kids are bored, then your activity is not, it's too big, or, you know, what, it's not challenging enough and you need to fix it. And so trying to flip that has been taking us, like, we've come a long way, but we still have a very, very long way to go. Yeah.
The African Confederation is always in the spotlight, being criticized. Do you deal with them closely? How's that been? And the Uganda FA as well.
Yeah, so we haven't. So we've, by design, kind of just stayed off onto our own and been able to try to just keep our head down and go to work and build a nice foundation before we start to talk to them. And so we're doing that now and spending a bit more time there and seeing how, you know, they can help us and we can help them from a development standpoint, kind of nationwide. So I think we'll get there. But no, you're right. It's messy. And again, it's a winning culture as well, even at the youth levels. And so that's why there's no development. That's why there's all the age cheating. And we see it it's hilarious. So our 14s will usually ask for a U16 team. So when we travel, we'll say, you know, give us your U16s. We don't tell them who they're playing. Because if we tell them they're playing 14s, then they won't bring them. So we ask for 16s, but then their 16s end up being 18s. So then I'm putting 13-year-old kid on the field. I have a 10-year-old on my 14s on the field with 18-year-old kids. And then and then we'll only lose, 3-1 or something. And so, but yeah, so there's not a, and we're trying to do a better job of that and lead by example on the age thing. Because then you're not putting them developmentally in a good spot either. It's this whole big kid culture and they'll be great for you today, but they'll never be a pro.
Yeah. Is there like an envy or jealousy with the other clubs in the area?
We've had some challenges. I would say 80% are really supportive and we're trying to provide coach training. We're trying to visit. We're trying to give back a little bit. And a lot of the models that do exist are on a really small scale compared to here, like a pay-to-play model where you'd pay a couple of bucks to go to their training over the weekend. And there's some coaches that are trying to do good things. So some of them see that if one of their kids makes it to us, then they can promote that locally and say, hey, we produce this player who's now at Football for Good in Gulu. He's now traveling 2 hours and playing there. That helps my business. There are some that still see us as a competitor. And it's going to take time. It's going to take education. But it hasn't been a huge issue for us. I think as we spread our tentacles and do ID more nationwide and start to grow, then we're probably going to run into a lot more of that. But yeah, we'll cross that bridge, I suppose, when we get to it.
Is it difficult to, I don't know how to say this, what are the expectations of the kids? Because I can imagine, especially a lot of the youngsters, they might have stars in their eyes and thinking, oh, I'm going to be the next Didier Drogba or I'm going to be the next Yaya Toure. So how much of that do you have to deal with and how do you sort of deal with it?
So it's funny, that's been more of a challenge with our older boys. So if it was by my choice right from the start, we probably would have just had an under 12 group and then grown in behind. Part of the community build and showing goodwill or what we're trying to do, we started with all three age groups. And so the older kids have been trained in an older environment, have been told that they're the best player on the planet for their whole lives. And so now they're 18 and we know their limitations. And so some of the older kids have and had unrealistic expectations about where they were as footballers and where they could go. So that's been harder in a real education. We've had a couple of boys move on because they have a brother who plays in the Ugandan Premier League and he's in the rear saying, well, you should just go to the school because they're going to do this X, Y. And so they want promises for us. And as we said to the kids all, I will never promise you anything. Here, all the doors are opening. We're very transparent about who we're talking to and what we're doing. And so the older boys, we had challenges early on. The younger ones, it's funny. They look up to players and we've talked a lot about being inspired and not comparing. And so, the kids are really inspired by the pros. I don't believe necessarily that, that we're talking to them a lot about creating their own pathway. And so, that hasn't been a huge challenge. It's funny. You mentioned Drogba and Toure and, they talk about, Dele Alli and Vardy. They don't seem to talk about the African players, which is hilarious. Not at all. There's an element of focus around, what am I going to do tomorrow? And I think it's interesting. I think from an academy standpoint, that's a detriment on the continent, period. I think there's, and for real reasons, real survival reasons, people generally aren't looking a month, a year, 3 years ahead because I'm just trying to, pull together enough money so I can pay my kids' school fees. And so it's really day to day, week to week. And so, which is what's special about what we're doing is we've taken a longer view and we've had the resources to do that, which makes us unique in the region. But also our kids still have the day-to-day mentality in many ways. And so they are, really focused on, they're more excited about who they're playing tomorrow, not the match that's on TV. They'll watch football. They just want to get on the field and have the ball at their foot. We train 5 days a week. We play Saturdays and they want more. We have to manage their bodies and everything else. But It hasn't been a problem yet. I think what I want for them, and James, you meant, like, is to have one of our kids go abroad and no longer be talk, but for that to be right. real. Mm-hmm. And so then they have something really to aspire to, and we can have one of our boys come back and tell the stories and talk about what's happening. And I think that'll be an important thing, not just for the community and the credibility, but for a real drive for our kids as well. Yeah.
Talk about the football culture there. You say the kids watch the games. If you're a Ugandan kid, I'm assuming the Premier League is everywhere, right? It owns the world. Is that the predominant league? And where do the kids watch the games? How many games can they watch? Who are the teams? Is it self-explanatory?
Yeah, so we have to, so it's all Prem. Spain has tried and others have tried to kind of sneak in, but it's, yeah, Premier League is everything. Arsenal and United is everything. Leicester Kitten popped up this year, but like like everywhere, that might not last long. There's a few ways for them. Like we can bring games in, so into the dorm, so that they can watch on the weekends. In the community, there are local setups where they'll show the games, not just at bars and pubs, but just at kind of movie or viewing centers that are just kind of either wood or tarped facilities that you can pay a small fee to go in and watch games. And so that's available. There's a lot of people who have in town anyways, who have means you can get a cable package and get games as well. For the few that have the means to do that. So there's ways to, and the unfortunate thing too, is there's bet shops all over the place. Like that's everything. And they're incredibly pervasive and a problem. But all the games are always shown there, and there's three of those on every block. So you can always peek your head in there to watch a game, and there's kids all over trying to watch there. So they'll find a way, for sure. They'll find a way.
Let's rewind quickly 18 months, 2 years ago, and your expectations. Have they been met? Have they been surpassed? How would you gauge the last 18 months of your life and Gulu?
Yeah, I'd say the first year was probably two expectations. And then say the last 6 to 8 months has really exceeded kind of what I thought was possible. I think the first year especially was really messy, and I had a lot to learn to work in that environment. I had a lot to learn around our kids and how we thought we could do things. And so that was slower and lots of ups and downs, and there'll be plenty of those. But now from where we are as an organization, like people wise and where the kids are from a development, I'd say we're at least a year ahead of where we thought we'd be. I didn't think we'd be having kids that I thought could be knocking on the door already. I thought that would be at least 3 years before we'd even be having that conversation. So that part's very, very exciting. And so I feel like we're ahead. And like I said, the conversations I'm having with pro clubs, this last trip has been, I've done it before, and this, the conversations are very different. And I'm not meeting with football people anymore. We're meeting with ownership and club presidents, and so we're getting in front of folks now, because there's the story we're telling and what we're doing now is gaining a real measure of credibility. And so I think that's a nod to how far we've come, that we're people at those levels are taking us seriously now. So it's been great.
Well, it's an amazing story. It really is. And congratulations, both professionally and personally. You're saying earlier off camera how, your boys have been back in Canada for about 8 weeks now, and they now want to get back.
They're ready
to Uganda. They're ready.
They're ready to go home. Yeah,
that's incredible. And that's fantastic. Yeah. Kids, they're so mobile. They can take them anywhere
for sure. Yeah,
they
put them in a suitcase and away they go.
They adapt. No, it's a fantastic story. Football for good. Football-for-good.org. Check it out for more information, more details. And we'll have Adrian back on the show, I'm sure, numerous times in the next months and hopefully years. You can stick around though for the rest of the podcast here. And you're a big supporter of Canadian soccer. You've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. Your boys have been involved in it for several years as well. This past week, Canada lost another coach, Benito Floro, the man that was brought in amidst much fanfare 3 years ago now, former Real Madrid manager. What could go wrong, they said? Well, another failed qualifying cycle for the World Cup has come and gone, J-Mo. Was it right to let him go now rather than let him build on what he's achieved so far?
I think it was the right move to let him go and to start anew. Although I do think you can make an argument, although I don't know how strong of an argument, that to let him stay and to build, because this constant turnover of coaches with the Canadian national team, you know, I think that's been part of the problem in terms of, you know, why we haven't been able to field a competitive team and sort of the culture of failure that has sort of, you know, overcome the Canadian soccer scene. So, you know, I get that, you know, people can make that argument. And you talk to some of the players, they're very high on Benito because they feel from a tactical and preparation point of view that they've never had played under a better coach. So I get that. But at the end of the day, you know, this team, I don't think it was any better than it was 4 years ago. In terms of the main objectives that he had, there were three. I mean, to do something at the Gold Cup, and they didn't. They didn't even score a goal in 2015, and they went out in the first round. For the Olympic men's team to qualify for Rio, and they didn't do that. And at the very least, to get to the Hex, and they didn't do that. So, as Victor Montagliani said, you know, this week, you know, it's a results business, and, you know, it can be a cruel business, but that's the way it is. And, you know, so I think it was the right move for them to part ways with Benito.
You mentioned, obviously, some players did benefit and enjoyed working under him. Other players didn't. Other players found it confusing. They thought it was old-fashioned. So there's a divide there, obviously.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, you look at some of those. We watched the games, Adrian. You watched games. You've been over here for 5 weeks now. Some of those moves he made in the Honduras match, in the last match against El Salvador, it's tough to critique and judge, you know, a guy with that kind of success and that kind of resume. But my word, some of those decisions he made, both selections, substitutions, I mean, you understand why some players are extremely frustrated, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the technical and tactical side and the kudos that's coming in, and I wouldn't doubt any of that, like, to your point of his resume. But yeah, especially the lineup against Honduras when you needed to go in and get a point. And just for me, you know, from the outside looking in, like, I thought their two best center backs were playing out of position. They were on the field, but they were out of position. And it felt like, you know, with Edgar and with, you know, Daniil Henry and all of his challenges, you know, he's played 70 MLS games and, you know, he's played a lot of center back with some good center backs. And I, you know, when you need to get a point, it just felt like sometimes it was too cute or too clever for its own good. Like, it felt like he was trying to do too much at times, or trying to do what no one expected, to show some level of knowledge or understanding beyond what everybody was writing in papers or talking about. So I don't know. Like, I agree. I think it was likely time to go. But, you know, now what is the question, right? Like, you know, to your point, like, you could, you know, ride it out and give him a chance to do that. And there's value in that, because now who's next? And is it going to be all the same problems? And how do you fill the spot? Because it's never been easy to fill that role and find the right person.
You get the feeling it's almost irrelevant to the coaches. The talent is what it is, right?
Yeah.
And I know they missed out by one point. And there's apologists who will say, you know, they should have qualified for the Hex. Well, they didn't qualify for the Hex.
Right.
And number one, it should be laid, I think, on the player's shoulders. Yeah, we can criticize a coach, admittedly, for the right reasons. But the talent isn't great. Perhaps it's better than it was 4 years ago, could be argued. Scott Arfield, I think, is being a big part of the future. But the next guy that comes in could be in charge of a team without Atiba Hutchinson, who might be the greatest Canadian of all time, quite possibly. That's a huge hole to fill. So, I mean, what is the long-term plan here? I mean, is it 4 years from now? I don't think it is.
It's interesting you say this, James, because in the aftermath of, you know, the elimination, I wrote a piece and I said, you know, at this point, I and maybe I'm being extreme, but I really think 2022 is a write-off. And I think we should be looking to 2026. And yeah, I mean, as much as people might not want to hear it, and I'm probably in the minority of this, I don't think that Canadian team was good enough to make it to the Hex. I mean, the player pool simply isn't there.
You know, it's funny. The narrative now with Canada is make it to the Hex.
Yeah.
That's the World Cup.
Well,
that isn't the World Cup.
But
no. That's the last round of qualifying.
But when you look at the history, like, the last time they made it was in the qualifying cycle for 98. So the Hex is quite...
I know, yeah. But what I'm reading, I'm hearing from these fans out there, they're saying, man, we're that close to the Hex. As if they've made the Hex, would there be ticker tape parades?
Yeah. Well, it feels close. It feels like the Hex is a 50-50 lottery. Like, that's how people feel. Like, if we could just get to the Hex and somebody slips on a banana peel and then we finish third, we get into the World Cup. Like, there's part of that because there are three spots and then the fourth is through the back door. And so it feels that close. We, you know, the realities of it not being considering who you need to play in those 10 matches. But I think that's why the level of excitement, those numbers are attractive. You know, if I was going to put my money down on a horse and it was 50-50, then I'd be on board. I think somehow that's how it feels like the fan base.
That half berth that would play against the Asia Confederations fourth place team, whatever it is, that, oh, that's the Holy Grail. You never know what could happen there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you think the passport should have anything to do with the next guy, or is it just the best candidate no matter where he's from?
No, it's the best candidate, whoever it's from. And I do think there's something to be said, and this isn't any disrespect to Benito, because you know, he did speak English, although not fluently, but I think communication is a big issue. And I'm not sure, I mean, I've heard from one or two players that communication was, that some of Benito's ideas got lost just because of the language barrier. He's, as I said, he speaks English, but he's not fluently. And I don't think at all times he could kind of clearly communicate what he wanted. So, yeah, if it's a foreign guy, then I absolutely have no problem with that. But he has to be able to clearly communicate his ideas, I think.
Maybe he wanted Danilo at centre back, just couldn't communicate it.
Maybe.
Right-sided centre back, and not right back. Maybe that
could
was the
be.
Issue.
Yeah, maybe.
I think the most important thing has to be, though, someone with experience, though, in CONCACAF. It's just a dreadful place to play, you know, as far as the officiating, the cynical tactics. Although we saw a bit of cynicism from Canada, actually, I thought, in the last game, which is refreshing to see.
Yeah.
I hate those tactics, but... Yeah. If you can't beat him, join him, right?
And they actually did. I mean, the last two games, they actually had some calls go their way.
They
which
did,
is
yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like,
bad calls, but calls go their
yeah,
way.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, so
still
they
bad officiating.
So they can't really sort of hang their head on that as to, oh, that's why we didn't qualify. Like, they really had the breaks in those last two games, I would say.
People, though, criticize, you know, how awful this job, who would want this job. But, you know, I was talking to Adrian before this, and, like, it isn't that bad a job in that you get pretty good money. You get to live in Canada, a wonderful country. You're at rock bottom, really. One way to go. There's very little pressure, right? It's not a soccer culture. There's a very vociferous minority that love this game and that team. But really, overall, I mean, it's a pretty comfy position for a professional coach, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's not the spotlight. You know, believe the spotlight is there, but the spotlight here is quite a small one, right? And it's no, I'd agree. I think. I mean, you know, I agree around two passport. It doesn't matter where they're from. I don't know how, you know, and this might, might not sound very Canadian and national pride to it, but I don't know how much we've dug in regards to the American pool of coaches and what's there. Mm-hmm. Maybe not have been head coaches, but others that have really kind of gone through that qualifying process, who have the tools, who could be the right candidate. I don't know who those people are, but you talk about understanding the environment, understanding our kids and the style of play. Having, you know, not dealing with the language barrier, you know, there might be a pool there that, you know, get ignored because sometimes you want, we say we don't, this passport doesn't matter, but does it matter in regards to how it plays in the media? Because it's Spain, because it's X, because it's Y. Is that easier for me to sell? And when it fails, well, you know, we got the best available candidate, as opposed to maybe to taking a risk on the right fit, to your point of the slog that is trying to get through CONCACAF.
You've mentioned before, Adrian, too. I mean, you've seen football around the world at the grassroots level more than most people. You think hunger could be a bit of an issue at the grassroots in Canada?
Yeah, I think it's so hard to question that. Like I thought how they scrapped and played. Like even the Honduras game that they lost. Like I don't think I would question character and desire there. I take issue too at times with the cynical tactics and the nonsense that goes on in CONCACAF. Like that's only a problem when you're chasing games. And so, you know, it's easy to, and we even talk about that with our own kids. Like, you know, if you're ahead in games and you're keeping your head down and you're going to work, none of that should matter. But when you're behind and you have, you know, you've got 20 minutes to find an equalizer and these guys are rolling around, you know, you've made your bed. And so I would love for us to stop worrying and paying attention to that and, you know, and fix the real problem. And it is about, you know, getting ahead in matches, winning matches, you know, being competitive and not worrying about how we're going to continue to chase games.
Yeah, I have a concern. It's not a concern, it's probably reality, really, that perhaps one of the most important signings in recent years has been Jason DeVos as director of development. We're only going to see the work Jason's done in about a decade from now, right?
Right.
You've got to reinvent the wheel in many ways. And I think the CSA has taken steps in that regard a number of years. There's been governance reform. There is a long-term plan now. There is a strategy in place, which now they've got to convince the clubs and academies to follow through with. But there's definitely progress. But you're talking about 2022, 2026. It might not be until 2030.
Could be.
And north of there that we start seeing, you know, the rewards from what's being put in place now, which is sobering to say the very least. But you never know. You could sneak in there perhaps in 8 years' time, perhaps. Rob Gale, under 20 coach, has some good players. He's doing some good work at age grade football right now. So you never know, but I like to think there's hope at least, but it may not be for a number of years.
Well, the hope may be that if they ever expand the World Cup to 40 teams.
Or host it.
Right. Maybe we co-host in 2026, maybe, you know, what are they talking about? Expanding it to 42?
40 or, yeah, well, you know, okay. Infantino.
So maybe
50 by that point.
So, you know, that's an extra slot or two for CONCACAF. Maybe then they sneak in.
Tell you what, if Uganda qualifies before Canada... Wow, then we've got some bigger problems to us.
They're higher up the FIFA ranking with no youth development system at all.
Are they really?
Yeah, I think Uganda, they just qualified for AFCON for the first time in 35 years. And I think now they're sitting like 68.
Wow. Yeah. Canada, the rankings came out today, so they dropped to 103.
Wow. And that's on the back of a very ordinary professional league and absolutely no youth development, right? Wow. And for me, so that goes back, what is that? It's culture.
Yeah,
it's all that is. You know, it's just how important the game is.
These kids need the soccer,
absolutely,
right? As opposed to perhaps, and we're fortunate perhaps that our kids don't need soccer,
right?
Yeah, you know, as far as hunger's concerned. But I know it's a discussion we'll keep having, I'm sure, for many, many years. But the next man in charge, who's your ideal candidate, John? Let me ask you this:
Bob Bradley. I know he's coaching the second division in France,
in Le Havre.
Yeah. But he's someone who's coached the U.S. national team, so someone who knows CONCACAF qualifying, who knows MLS, who's managed teams in Europe. So for me, I think you throw a whole pile of money at him and convince him to come.
Because there's so much money just laying around at the CSA, you know. Look down the couch cushions.
Well, Benito didn't come cheap, right?
Was it a million?
Yeah.
Reportedly, well, speculated.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you can, you know, throw some of that money around and bring in Bob Bradley. I mean, and I just think Bob is a very good coach as well. And I think he would be the perfect fit.
Can we just stop with this whole John Herdman idea?
Are people saying that?
Oh, though? I'm seeing all the time. It should be John Herdman. John Herdman's got a pretty sweet gig right now.
I
think the CSA is pretty happy having him run one of the more successful women's programs in the world.
Right? And I think he's pretty happy too.
Yeah.
So I don't
just
see
stop
that happen.
With that, people. If you want to comment on social media about should be John Herdman, like just don't. It's not going to happen. Maybe one day, but he's got to go away first and come back. Anyway,
maybe.
Listen, let's stop with that. Champs League this week, JMO. I'm sure you watched every single game. You probably taped it, no?
No, because I was. The Benito thing kind of
ruined your Champs League watching.
Ruined my day yesterday.
You didn't see Barcelona's, I guess that was Tuesday.
Well, I did see some of that. My God.
7-0 over Celtic.
Boys to men. Just boys to men. I really, and this isn't going to be popular, I know, but like they really got to do a better job of weeding out teams like Celtic and Rostov.
Ooh, boy, you're who lost 5-0.
Well, I mean,
you're a brave man.
There's and that's why, you know, the whole sort of how they're going to redo the Champions League where they'll get four guaranteed teams. I really don't have that much of a problem with it, to be perfectly honest.
I know. There's a big divide, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably Celtic started off this SPL pretty good. Smashed Rangers last week in the first Old Firm in 4 years in the league, and then they meet Barcelona.
They're crushed. I mean, that was, you know, wasn't even a contest.
PSG should have smashed Arsenal too.
Yeah, they threw
1-1 there.
They threw that one away.
Edison Cavani doing his Olivier Giroud impression. Oof. My word. Yeah. A couple of missed chances there, huh?
Yeah.
Wednesday's action, let me see. Oh, yeah, City beat Mönchengladbach 4-0. A good Mönchengladbach
team.
Very
good.
This City team is looking ominous.
Yeah.
They really are. Spurs fell to Monaco 2-1 at Wembley. Pochettino said post-match, you know, he wished he could sub all his players off because they were that bad.
Wow.
He criticized the atmosphere at Wembley as well.
Why did they play at Wembley?
Because they're rebuilding, knocking down essentially Spurs at White Hart Lane.
Oh, are they really?
So, and well, this year, obviously, because of Champs League, can get more people in there.
Ah, right? Okay.
But then they are going to play, I think next season, all their games at White Hart, at Wembley before the new stadium.
But they're not there this year.
No, just the Champions League.
So they could play at White Hart Lane this
year. Money.
Okay. Was that building full?
It was about 80,000.
It was about 80,000, yeah.
Yeah.
But what is that to the point? What does that do for home field advantage? And and that's you know, that's a very good side. I saw bits and pieces of that yesterday, and they were completely dominated. They weren't in the match. They were lucky. The score was flattering for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Monaco, you know, the good little team. Bernardo was outstanding in that match. Mm-hmm. When he's healthy, he's very, very good. But yeah, I think you're right. It's not a home field advantage at all. What else? Leicester beat Bruges 3-0. Welcome to the Champs League, Leicester.
Yeah, good for them.
It's Bruges though, isn't it?
Yeah. That's another one.
Nice to see Riyad Mahrez wake up though.
Yeah, for a change.
Played really well.
Yeah, he did play well.
Ranieri said that the Champions League music awoken the beast that is Riyad Mahrez. All right, boys, we should get out of here because we're going to get screamed at by Jazz behind the glass pretty soon. This weekend, to hell with you, Jazz. We want to leave.
It's a baseball podcast coming up. Who cares?
Oh. They still playing baseball? I'm watching. This weekend, 9:30 on Sportsnet, Hull against Arsenal. We have Everton against Middlesbrough as well. Then Sunday, please join us because I'll be live on TV at 6:30 in the morning. Oh, God. That's going to be rough. A lot of makeup. It's Watford against Manchester United, though. So, United fans, get up, roll out of bed, get a cup of coffee on, and watch some football, and watch me and Craig die in front of you. After that, we got Palace against Stoke, and then Spurs, the aforementioned Spurs, against Sunderland at 11 a.m. Eastern. So, lots of football this weekend across Sportsnet, plus, of course, Bundesliga as well. Check out sportsnet.ca for the coverage. JMO, what else is on the website currently that the listeners have to read?
It's not on the site yet, but I'm going to have a story later today because I asked Jose Altidore about his kind of views on the whole sort of national anthem debate that's going on in the States with Colin Kaepernick and the protests and everything. So he added a pretty interesting take, and Jose is a Jehovah's Witness. So
is he?
Yeah. So apparently they don't sort of believe in national anthem. Well, I mean, he'll stand, but he doesn't sort of sing or put his hand on his chest like a lot of people do. So not that that's just their faith. It's not he's protesting, but even then still, he's been getting a lot of flack for that over the years. So it was kind of interesting to get his take on that in relation to what Kaepernick is doing.
And that'll be on later today?
Yeah.
How come his nickname isn't the Watchtower?
How come what?
His nickname isn't the Watchtower. That's the Jehovah's Witness publication, isn't it, I believe?
Oh, that's right. I don't know.
It used to be anyway.
Oh, there you go.
And the Watchtower, he's a big guy, the Watchtower.
There you go.
Maybe you started it right there.
Hashtag
Watchtower.
I like that. All right, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Adrian Bradbury, as mentioned before, football for good, football-for-good.org. All your information is a wonderful, wonderful business. It's nice to say it's a business. Moving forward, and we'll have you on real soon to discuss more about it.
Great.
Hope you enjoyed that, guys. We're back on Monday, myself, Dobby, and Dunlop. Until then, enjoy the games, and cheers for listening.